You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore.
This is Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FM. And this is Sound Poetry. And I would like you to meet today a poet from the Northwest, from Seattle, editor and publisher of anthologies of poetry, owner of the Five Willows Press. He has published poetry since he was quite a young man. He is from China, from a village near Canton, Kun Woon. And he has a wonderful book that has most of his poetry from over the decades called Water Chasing Water, that is put out by a press that is different from your own presses, right? This one called Kaya Press?
Yes, that's correct.
Kun Woon's Water Chasing Water. Wonderful poetry that you're going to hear today. I think we're going to start out with your reading, Kun. Welcome to Sound Poetry.
Like Water Chasing Water, the main
the title of
the book, which is a very beautiful, I think, ample book of the Kaya Press that has many of the years of Kun's poetry. This is one where you will find, I think, the greatest variety in one book at present, as far as I know them. And I couldn't pick just one or two out of this to say they are the best. All the poems that you read are so wonderful in their imagery. They continue to flow from page to page. But like water, chasing water.
Like water chasing water under the bridge. We are who we are because of the flow, the limpid octave gargle that follows sons and daughters of liquid empires, forever subsumed to the undercurrent pole. Because of this, we repeat generation upon generation of the chase, the continuous rush to fill erroneous time. And if man, the fisher, casts forever lines and lines in waterfalls and birds circle freely, and not a moment is without its color, then the days will relax the rigidity, become supple, and bless us with the liquidity of beliefs, at once bearable and expandable, and subsume the proportions of lakes. And so make this river flow into the lake, and take this swirling and make it an ocean.
Water chasing water flows through the page and gives you a fullness of liquidity as you realize that you're carried along in a stream. That's, I think, one of the effects that you have in several of these poems, which should be if you title your book that. But there are some images that perhaps are somewhat more static, you might say static, but when you read them, maybe not so. One called Cold Stones.
Cold Stones. With copper coins and amulets from the Sung Dynasty, dispel these ghosts of regret. We sat face to face at a tea house in Tian'an. I call upon your name, the old man from Nan'an. Perhaps one should say, this tea comes from the high hills of, or perhaps, this teacup is an old relic. We reach into our pockets to find words, but only possess cold stones. The cups are emptied and emptied again, with the rapidity of a schoolboy rattling the names of the dynasties. We are old men forever parting, never joining. This is the chasm, not by water and not by years, but by glances that implore and by words that fail us. When we reach into our pockets for something to give, cold stones. Soul to soul, we have never met. Our little wars drew us together. Now there's peace over the hills. Now peasants are rebuilding huts. Can we now repair ourselves? Or must we, like condemned men, carry cold stones in our pockets?
So on the page that follows, although you might have thought cold stones was the suitable conclusion to that, It does actually take a lift in the last part. Little wars drew us together. Uh-huh. Now there's peace over the hills. We always have to take a moment to see whether or not two lines or a verse remains on the other side. Uh-huh. Right. Anyway, would you like to read about the goldfish in the bowl?
By the way, Goldfish, my first published poem in 1985, and that won me to a spot on the literary stage, the Bumbershoot Literary Festival. So,
is this the poem, Goldfish, that did it?
Yeah, this is the poem.
Won the prize. Good. We're ready.
It's my first poem that won any kind of money.
Here we go.
Goldfish. The goldfish in my bowl turns into carp each night, swimming in circles in the day, regal, admired by emperors. But each night, while asleep, it turns into silver, a dagger cold and sharp, couched in one spot, enough to frighten cats. The rest of the furniture squats in the cold and dark, complains of being a lone man's furnishings, and plots of revolt. I can hear myself snore, but not the infidelity. Sometimes awake with a start. Silently, they move back into their places. I have been unpopular with myself, pacing in my small square room. But my uncle said, even in a palace, you can but sleep in one room. With this, I become humble as a simple preacher, saying, I have no powers. They emanate from God. With this, I sleep soundly. Fish or no fish, dagger or no dagger. When I wake, my fish is gold. It pleases me with a trail of bubbles. My furniture has been loyal all night, waiting to provide me comfort. There was no conspiracy against a poor man. With this, I consider myself king.
So, do you find furniture still complains at times?
They must move more quickly than they used to, because whenever I look at them, they seem to be stationary.
So, your furniture is all, so it's more loyal if it stays there, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, they move faster back into place, you know, before.
We'd have a chance to hear your long poem in Water Buffalo Time, which is so many images in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's bound to please any listener of verse.
How this poem came about was I woke up one morning, I heard these lines going in my head, so I wrote them down as a scribe. I didn't alter anything what I heard. And I got about one third of this poem, and then I stopped. I couldn't hear anything more. Then the next day, it happened again. When I woke up, the lines run in my head. So I wrote them down again. Then the beginning to look like a poem. I was afraid it never come back, you know, that my mind would work that way again, never come back again. But then the third day, it happened again, and I finished the poem. I took to do a reading in the University of Washington. I have no idea if this was a poem or not, because normally I have to think about writing a poem, but this came by itself. So I read the whole poem, and there was an editor developing art there. He said, can we have this poem, please? So I gave it to them. It was published.
Great choice to read it.
Uh-huh.
That's daring, too, isn't it, to read something that you haven't even
I didn't even know.
Become accustomed to yourself.
Yeah, right. And that's never happened quite like that again.
Well, we're ready for In Water Buffalo Time.
In Water Buffalo Time. The water buffalo is a black boulder around which white butterflies flit, controlling the image of my village. It is four pillars holding up a shrine topped by Attila's head, slapping his paintbrush tail. Sure-footed, it advances slowly, not impressed by dynastic inventions of paper, gunpowder, or compass, nor by imperial vassals intoxicating concubines with plum wine. This working philosopher, benign beast of the East, is a prince meditating on plum blossoms, while the kingdom is overrun by brigands, no different from soldiers. It sinks its head into the grass on the perimeter of the village pond, where daggers of carp and dace rip its shadow on the water, where black shrimp and loaches scout the bottom, and snails cling to slate banks. In earliest mornings, I woke to the village dialect jostling in my head like cauliflowers sizzling in sesame oil in the walk, like chatty sparrows in a young tree, like cicadas in bamboo groves, like buckets splashing in the village well. I had heard the drinking song of the men in the village yard the night before, with bamboo pipes in a bucket of rice wine they had sung. Heavy, heavy, the dew lies over the clovers. Ring, bring out flash of silver. Merry, merry under dormant stars. But soon, too soon, this night will be over. Voices taut, frog drum deep as rice paddies, but I dream a deeper voice than my father's pales in comparison. It was hindered by kung fu drums, bellow of water buffalo, a racine fissure. It was his proclaimed Lu Xun. In the stillness of mountains, hear the peal of thunder. But when I wake, the dew was gone, a shaft of sunlight fell on my childhood slate. My sister renews the Ming vase with fresh pushy willows, and grandmother steams rice, and a chicken sits on a new egg. I drink tea from the spout when my sister redoes my shoelaces. Off to school, three leagues away, trotting on village pond banks and collecting schoolmates in the morning haze. When I see a water snake swimming in the lotus pond, I deja vu Narcissus lost his life. His gifts came early, and ours not at all. We are the contingent of zodiac animals. Off to seek Buddha, the horse, the rabbit, the tiger, the rooster. The ox trots out first, faithful, steadfast. When he arrives, the rat on his back jumped off and got to Buddha first. I often meditate at the pond near the school, watching the soft, thin legs of the praying mantis subdue a bug in full armor, seeing it as the monks did at the Shaolin Temple 500 years before. Other masters studied the movement of cranks, eagles, and birds fighting with snakes. Li Bo, our legendary poet, in 700 AD, perfected the drunkard style of kung fu, which bewilders the opponent with fluid but erratic movements. When my little friends mock me of my seriousness, my teacher, under the shade of the young tree bursting with berries, told us Manger dreamt he was a butterfly, dreaming it was a man. I was confused, in a house of mirrors, and thought existence is mutual illusion. Would I cease to exist within finger my dog, who thinks of me? My little friends made faces at me. New Year comes to the village banging a gong and exploding demon-chasing firecrackers and lucky money. But the village recedes away like the galaxies. In these 30 years, What will not change in form or utility except art for its own sake? Heraclitus says, I can't cross the same river twice. Einstein says, if I must, I can go to the future, but never to the past. But surely, as long as one water buffalo is fanned by the evening breeze, the village is there like the smile of the Cheshire cat and exists in the platonic world. All else is an approximation. Sunflowers, yellow and white chrysanthemum, lychees, girls' red cheeks, dew moist winter melons, little Buddhas in the garden, robins, beetles, and cicadas sing my way to my uncle's village. He rises and his wife burns incense. He clears the abacus with one motion and teaches me the rhymes that one chants to enable the fingers to go faster than the brain. He is a wine merchant steeped in Confucius. Where would a woman wash her husband's clothes if not at the river by the ancestral shrine? What part of the chicken to give to the nephew if not the drumstick? And how else to measure but by exact yards and inches? He has many children, but there's no unnecessary noise. I forage the pine hills behind his house as a bandit. The turpentine from the virgin pines makes me dizzy. The wood is kept as furniture for newlyweds. I play until I fear real bandits will come. The sky devoured with thousands of incense tips. But surely, memory is selective. I don't remember not having my mother's milk, only the quarrels with village women my mother's age. I don't remember three generations of a family taken by dysentery, just the bitter cod liver oil my grandmother spooned me. I don't remember my cold little toe, except that cloth was allotted only once a year, and only in black or blue. I don't remember famines, just the human chain formed to relay water to the stricken rice paddies, where the leeches also dehydrated. Still, village girls marry as soon as the dew evaporates from the corn. The mulberries was jumping into the village pond. What China had, we had. And when it was all quiet, the sunflowers turned. The papayas got fat and golden. And peasants trot out with holes and straw hats. It was quiet in the garden, where fish into the pond. Peas incubate in pots, and lettuce fall and clean, and ladybugs monitor the gardens to make sure this is the order things before the invention of mail delivery. In the semi-tropical evening, pink clouds raise and diffuse like colors and textures on my jade bracelet. The water buffalo is led into the dusty village yard. Mud cake on his loins, distracted by my dog cutting across his path. He collects his primeval motions into shape, shakes his Hegelian head, exhales, slaps his paintbrush tail, lapses into reverie, and goes into internal monologue. O beast I am, humble beast, some man, he must have been an emperor, or the son of such an emperor. Said, the original sun is the mother of the universe, the sword that divines life from chaos, the mother of all things. The sun atop the tree is east. The mountains seek comfort in the hills. The hills seek rest in the valleys, and the valleys beget rivers. The mountain cat descends into the lowlands, and a few mice look up for hawks. And the darkening earth looks for the moon. Loving the grasses of I have for 30 years, first owned by one man, then by his son, the mountains are unvarying, with mud cake on my loins, trudging the maize rice fields, a black dot against unvarying mountains. The soil furrows, my eyebrows moisten, the bitter sweet song of my master, himself deep in mud, the fury of work, calculating how many bowls of rice the harvest will give. A A beast is not able to calculate moles, calories, and grains. Work begins when the monsoons recede. In the evening, when I'm sufficiently grazed, I sink into the village pond and drop down for black shrimps. Yet a man with all skill on an abacus is afraid of things he cannot see. The man and his family are afraid of dark, gloomy gods handed down to them, and by copious amounts of incense and charms. My mother, whose teeth I suckle for only a brief while, gave me no such gods or thunder to fear. I don't even fear tigers. A man is cursed with worry. Thieves, because he has too much. Fires, because he's careless. And ghosts, because he offends others. But I, with the gold-plated sky for blanket, sweet-smelling rice straws for bed, breeze from the river, I have recompense for my toil. With the village symphony of crickets, cicadas, and bullfrogs, I shall say beasthood is as good as Buddhahood. I conjecture a water buffalo, constellation in another galaxy, a real spirit, not a tattered array of dying stars, a form, but not only a form. Up in heavens, my soulmate has no ring pierced through his elegant nose, and no harness to shackle him down. And here below, a beast can speak, we will form quorums and overthrow empires by conspiracy of tales. But alas, nature gave us no such voice equipment, just the reluctant compliance to serve, though our masters in turn fear tax collectors. It's we who are sole exchange or place on the chopping block. We do not think? No. Our lack is our intelligence is not equal to our strength. The beast is weary, is led by a boy to a bed of straw, inside our house. In the cursing lamplight, my sister undoes a ponytail, which a while ago was a bowstring. Back from a political meeting, she says tractors will come to our village. When electric lamps light up the village yard, she says ghosts will be gone. Grandmother, her feet bound in the last dynasty, will see new light with her old eyes. She gives me crackers and tea and draws the mosquito net. I hear a faint moan from the water buffalo. He too will be liberated. Though the past is solipsistic, his existence requiring a mind to behold it, childhood writes indelibly a $1 million check into life. Dragonflies hover over chrysanthemums like helicopters over a burning forest. Bananas and grapes bunch together like families. Women splash buckets into the well. I look for faint prints of the water buffalo. The water buffalo got old and died. It was shared by the whole village. Lucky money for a calf conscripted. A sad note crept into the men's drinking songs. But not for long. With rice wine, they sang again of subduing tigers and various calamities from the beginning of time. On my childhood slate were drawings of chickens, mulberries, and numerals from Arabia. Then I learned to write the characters. Water buffalo.
And how was that received when you read that?
Well, according to the editor, publisher of the Bellary Art magazine, which is quite popular for a number of years in Seattle, he said that was the best poem he ever published.
Mm-hmm.
And my publisher, Kaya Press, is, we got to have that in the book, so... So it's still in the first edition, in the first book, Truth and Render Rooms, have been reprinted, this Water Shaped Water.
Well, there's never been a more famous water buffalo that could speak like that.
Yeah, and the thing is, there's a microcosm of my village, which is a microcosm of China, which was a rural country at that time.
Yeah. So the water buffalo then was an image that was connected to your village.
Yeah, I see that right away.
What was the name of the village again?
Nan On, which means South Peace.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the southern China, near Guangzhou, which is used to be called Canton.
Have you any one poem that you yourself would like to choose to read that would be say your choice, your favorite.
Well, how about this strange poem that just hit me unaware. I don't know where it came from, how it manifests itself, but here it is. The disembodied hand. The word disembodied came from a class I took one time in philosophy class, the philosophy of mind. It was called the disembodied existence, where a person could transfer all his identity into a computer. So there's no longer, the mind is no, body is no longer needed for identity. So this is a disembodied hand. That doesn't mean that hand is still there. I don't actually know what it means, but I'll read it anyway. The disembodied hand. The hand that moves across the sterile hours in a ward for the insane, that wanders off the bare breasts of mad women hungering for touch, behind locked doors forever locked out of consciousness, of those who toil in broad daylight for a loaf of illogic, just so that the fat mouths of children go on sucking. The hand that is stationary on the defunct clock indicates ill repair. The mistakenly purchased hand from a second-hand store, fabricated from plastics in the impoverished sectors in Hong Kong by those who are disconnected from this great financial center. Immigrants who have not been in this country long, nor do they see it as a permanent place in their hearts, they too have hands. The hand that is penning this, the tire, effete and worn hand, betrays a heart that is becoming callous, as the opposition calls for sufferance from the body politics that the hand has been feeding. All hands will be on deck to be judged, and should they be tired of being judged, then abandoned, locked away, and then the hand, the disembodied hand, the hand that belongs to no one, and yet it belongs to everyone, the hand, the hand, the hand, the hand that will finally pick up a weapon, because this disembodied hand belongs to no one and everyone, the hand, the hand, the hand, give us a hand.
Thank you for your generosity in reading so many of your works, Kuhn. You are a very powerful poet that can spin images that seem to go on, and the image of the hand, so various in that particular poem there, is quite an interesting mystery. What have you prepared there is also, you say, something that you haven't quite digested, you haven't come to. Mm-hmm. But that's the way with many poets, I believe. They later on, a poet can look at a work and not necessarily recognize what was the point of that, that phrase, that verse. But anyway, can't thank you enough. It's been a wonderful afternoon. Thank you.
And thank you for having me, David.
This is Sound Poetry. I've been your host, David Gilmore, with Seattle poet Kuhn Wu.